Thank you. All right, everyone, and good evening to Studio W The Buzz, your global radio network, and the Soul Sadness Show with EB, Q Lynn, Whitney, and special guest Monty. Good afternoon, y'all. How are you?
I'm great. This is Monty. Hi, everybody.
Monty.
Yeah.
Monty!
I'm good now that I'm here. This has been a long day, and it's been a long week.
I feel like this is the last show.
Oh, my God. I feel like because I had so much stuff jam-packed in, and there's so much stuff going on. But, yeah, like Will said, we got special guests. You gotta add the extras in there, Will. We got veteran musician. You got to put emphasis on that because that's a big deal. Veteran musician, Monty Croft. And we, I was like, yes, we got that in the budget now, Monty. We got classic and stuff. Yes, round of applause for Monty Croft.
And
week for Black Music Month. Because tomorrow
that applause sounded crazy on my phone.
Yes, absolutely. And then Black Music Month, the last week for us for Black Music Month. So I was like, why not talk about musicians? Because the last time we talked about background singers and stuff like that and our favorite singers, but we never did like a whole show talking about musicians. And I was like, and we talking about if we really want to be honest, the creators of Black music is the musicians, if we keeping it honest, if we go all the way back. You know what I mean?
Right.
Cause that's
how it started.
The foundation of it all. So we're going to do the Savvy updates real quick and just update real quick before we get into it. Last week's show was crazy. We had two singers on. We had Ray. He had a new album that came out called Love's on the Way, and we played a few of his songs on the show. Pretty good R&B. And then also we had American Idol contestant Thaddeus Johnson that was on, I think, this year's American Idol on ABC. He's a contestant on there. He was on with us last week, the end of the show. And yeah, it was a fun packed show. I'm still getting ready to post that soon. So I just want to know before we get started, like what you said you had along with EB. What does that entail? Where have you been up to? And then we just gonna go around and before we go break again.
You it's New York and it's summertime and everybody wants to do everything all of the time. Like a couple of my friends had gigs this week. So I'm trying to go to everybody's gig at the same time. It's 3,078 degrees outside, so I'm sweating, and I don't like sweating. And
but
it's like I got
to
go to
the Sugar Bar.
Yeah, I mean,
waiting on you at the Sugar Bar, EB.
Listen, Monty, listen. You know what? I have a story about the Sugar Bar. I was on a date maybe 2 months ago, and I was coming to the Sugar Bar. But it wasn't Wednesday. I know you're there on Wednesdays, right?
Yeah.
It was on a Thursday. And okay. I was like, oh, on Thursday, I think they have karaoke. I know Wednesday is, your night.
No, they have an open mic, live band.
Oh, yes. They have open mic. That was it. Open mic on a Thursday. So, you know, we walk to the Sugar Bar and we get to the front and the guy's like $10. Mm-hmm. Now, normally I would have been like, oh yeah. But the problem was that whoever was on the stage at the time was not good at all. And we were allowed to hear that. Like, you can't charge me to get into a show when I can hear that who you have on stage right now is not good. Like, I've been to the Sugar Bar a million times, and there's amazing talent that comes through there. So I'm always happy to give my $10. But that particular night, I was just like, no, I can't do it.
You've been like a million times? Really? Like a million times?
You know what? I have.
You have not come to one of my gigs in this whole year.
Let me tell you.
Call them out, Monty. Call them out.
No,
I've been getting on the tube by going.
That's right, Monty.
Because I told him multiple times to go there. He's like, I got to plan it.
Get it, Monty.
He got all kinds of.
That's right, Monty. Get him.
Hey. Monty, if anybody understands, I know you understand. I'm not going to give out the location of where you live, but I know you don't live in Manhattan.
Right.
And you understand, I live in Brooklyn. Sometimes traveling to the Sugar Bar in the Upper West Side.
I get that.
It can be a bit challenging, especially
right.
late at night because then the train's not running.
Right.
And
yeah,
and if you're driving, it's like parking, and if not the parking, then, you know.
Right.
Monty, I'm going to make it up.
You're covered on the parking on Wednesday. West 71st Street. I always park. There's always plenty of parking.
What street is that?
West 71st.
On 71st.
You know, the Sugar Bar is on 72nd.
72nd, right. Okay,
so you can always find parking there.
I'm coming through, and
please.
when I get there, Monty, I need you just to give me the mic.
Uh-oh.
And I'm gonna hit my best Minnie Riperton.
Oh no!
Oh no!
What have I done?
And I'm gonna give the people a show.
You
I don't
know what you
want to say.
Oh
no!
Oh my God!
I don't understand.
Oh Lord!
I feel like Minnie Riperton is. Y'all don't think I sound like Minnie Riperton? I mean,
I will fly up there if you give me a couple weeks notice to let me
listen,
know you're going to do
all right,
it. Like,
all right,
I will come up
do.
There and support you.
I didn't know what song I'm singing and everything, so we good.
Uh-huh.
Minnie Riperton.
Okay.
Monty, you know the catalog. I need y'all to practice.
I'm flying from California.
Sure, okay. You really turned that around on me.
I mean, listen.
Because now I don't want to see you.
Listen, you put it on me. I had to put it back on you.
Well, you got four chances in July. I'm doing
right.
a Nick Ashford's Nothing But the Blues night. That's a Tuesday. They feature different artists, so I'm featured on the 10th and the 17th. And then our regular band is still playing on Wednesday on the 11th and the 18th. So, you know, I really need you there. I need you there on the blues nights especially.
I'm thinking the 17th is when I'm going to come through. You know, I am huge Ashford and Simpson fans. I just posted the other day their song "Somebody Told a Lie" is my favorite and Simpson song. But on the 17th, Blues Night, I'm there.
Great, great. That'll be fantastic. Look forward to.
I'm gonna need
you.
An autograph, a half order of chicken wings, and a whiskey.
He got a whole list.
I could tell he knows the Sugar Bar because the chef is on point.
Oh, I know the Sugar Bar. Trust me, I know the Sugar Bar.
All right.
But that's why my week has been so
long. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was saying that's why my week has been so long. It's just been running around in this heat and then work during the day and in the evening, like we had Ray on last week. I interviewed Ray 2 weeks ago.
He just goes by Ray?
He just goes by Ray, and he's in Harlem, actually.
Okay.
So, and I actually would love to introduce you to because I would love to get Ray in front of a live band. His album is amazing. And
yeah, I was telling him you could tour off that album. It's solid.
Yeah, his album is amazing. And he sent me some tracks that were not on the album that were recorded. And he's so talented. We both have, like, South Carolina roots. We're both from South Carolina and living in New York now. So we connected off of that. And we're both, like, soul music purists. Like, we love the 60s and 70s and the 80s. That's, like, you know, what we gravitate towards. And I would love to introduce you to and see if we can get him in front of a band or see if we can get you playing for him or something. Because he deserves and you deserve.
Oh, right on. I would love to meet him.
Yeah.
You know, we don't do the open mic thing with our band, you know. That's the
thing.
But I always love to meet great artists, you know, new people. Yeah, it would be an honor. Absolutely.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Got any gigs, Q?
Say it again.
Got any gigs?
Yeah, I got one actually. Bob Wallman talking about he could be in two places at one time. I think I'm like literally doing that right now in the next 2 hours. I got to be in two places at one time. So yeah, it's a pretty fun gig. I like doing corporate gigs because then I can like get a feel of the crowd and it's like easy. Like it's like usually middle aged people. So I try to like when we perform, the band play together. I try to do it like a DJ set and like play like just endless songs that I know they'll like, and it usually works. I just try to like figure out the crowd and stuff like that, and it's a pretty fun gig. But yeah,
like me.
yeah, like late 40s going into maybe mid 50s, They love anything. Hey. Kenny Loggins. They
That's
they
me
love,
right there.
They
all
love
day.
Like Michael McDonald. They love 80s
That's
and
right.
they like some folk music. And I play some of that. Yeah, they love all that stuff. So I try to like keep it diverse, you know, in terms of the stuff we play. But yeah, I was gonna ask Whitney, what have you been up to this week? I know you you had a few couple questions, and I know Pino Grigio will kind of ruined that last week, as I knew you had something. You got your journalistic hat on, and you had all of it set
wait.
Up. We're gonna let you ask Monty some questions when we go on the break. When we come back from break.
Before
go ahead.
Whitney says anything, I just found out today that Whitney is engaged.
Oh, you did, she mentioned it on the show, like what was
where
it?
Was I? I had no idea.
She said she had a fiance on the show. I forgot when it was. It was like earlier this year though.
Yo,
I was like, oh,
I
yeah. But she had told me off air though.
And she, she answered and she said, my fiance, and I was like, yo, who? Yo, what? Like, what?
Wait, no. How did you find out again? What'd you say? I missed that.
You know, today I was talking about 1992 in music on Twitter and all of the R&B, hip-hop, and also movie soundtracks that came out that year. And she responded about the Juice soundtrack, about a cup she had with Tupac on it from Juice as Bishop. And she said, my fiance said, or my fiance's friend. And I was like, yo, what? Like, you out here with a whole fiance, and you on the Soul Savage show on me every Friday flirting with me? Like, see, I don't appreciate that. If your fiance is listening.
Be like me, because I'm going to come up with a whole husband. You mad at that? Well, when I get a whole husband, you going to be mad about that. You like, oh, I know you got married. Yeah, that's how I wanted it.
I don't like to see. Y'all let me know up front.
You even know I was
right,
EB. For now here. You didn't even know I was an eligible girlfriend out here until I said it one time. Wait,
see,
no, I think I said
no,
it.
No, I didn't. Because you know what? I don't really pry, like, in the people's lives. But I didn't know. Like, I'm learning a lot about y'all, and I don't know if I like everything I'm learning. Whitney. Hey, how you doing?
Wow. Did I call on the wrong night?
Right. All this inner turmoil on the show. Family feud, as Jay-Z called it.
This is the tough line.
We got all kinds of family feuds going on. To people listening, eligible girlfriend means when you got a job and you're still looking at the same time. That's what that means. What we're going to do right here, we're going to go break. And we're going to go to break, and we'll be back. We're going to do a little short, little mini interview with Monty, because my interview is technically called music therapy, because I need it at the moment, and I feel like instead of paying for a therapist, I feel like Monty is like the best thing, so we gonna get this out the way. So I'm
gonna quit. The doctor is in.
We'll be back, y'all. Y'all get into these music tunes real quick. We'll be back.
destroyers, ubiquity, mystic voyage, and welcome back. This is Studio W The Buzz, the hottest thing on the planet, along with the Soul Savage Show. A welcome back, our special guest Monty, your host, Q Lynn Green, EB, and Whitney. Hey, EB, have to agree with you, and thank you and Monty for putting together that playlist. 60s, 70s, and 80s. That's real music.
Oh, yeah. Roy Ayers is a classic. Like, he is, he and George Duke are,
yeah,
to me,
oh, man,
just amazing in the way that they were able to merge the worlds of traditional jazz with hip-hop, R&B, and influence, like, all the generations since. Like, they are, in my eyes, like, the greatest of all time. Like, they did it. I'm still a Roy Ayers fan. Like, he did the NPR Tiny Desk a few weeks ago. Amazing.
Yeah. Wow.
Amazing.
Hey,
yeah, that was actually, you well, said hip-hop, that was actually before hip-hop.
Yes.
Right,
George,
exactly.
George and Roy, like, they influenced hip-hop, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
No. Just cold stuff, man, I'm telling you.
Yeah, and that song, I selected that one. That was one of the first vibraphone solos. You know, one of the instruments I play is a vibraphone.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned maybe the first part of it, like the real melodic part before he goes into all that blues stuff. And it's just so funny listening to it now. I mean, it still sounds phenomenal. But when I was a kid, I was like 14 when I, you know, tried to learn the stuff and, you know, it just seemed like it was just so much. It's like, whoa, my God, what is he doing? What is he doing? And now to my ear, you know, it just sounds so simple to me. I mean, and
right,
don't get the wrong impression. I don't want people to say, oh, Monty said Roy Ayers is simple. I'm not saying that. I'm saying he's phenomenal. The solo still sounds perfect, but I'm just illustrating how your ears grow and, you know, things sound different. You know, when I was 14, it was just, that was like a big mountain, and it's like, now I listen to it, and I'm like, wow, it's not even really that deep. I mean, it's, you know, again, it's great. It's a lot of energy, and but it's really the same language going through the whole solo, you know. So
right.
It's just deep to me as I was listening to it right now, because I remember when I was 14, I didn't even want to mess with any of that stuff, like in the middle and the end of the solo. I just learned that little, the build.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but Roy is incredible. Big influence, like one of my first influences, for sure.
Monty, did you ever see him in person?
Yeah, I've seen Roy a few times.
What a concert.
He's amazing live. Amazing live.
Right, that's right. I saw him in my hometown, even. You believe that, back in Ohio, Youngstown, Ohio, I saw Roy Ayers. I think that was the first time I saw him. And George Duke, yeah, I'm a huge George Duke fan as well. I was so heartbroken when he checked out of here. I just couldn't believe it.
Right. Same.
You know, it's crazy. I actually had a chance to play for, he was doing the Jeffrey Osborne show, and he was playing the keyboard, and I got a chance to back for him on that, and I was so nervous because we was doing Jeffrey Osborne set, and he could tell, like, he wasn't even looking at me. I could see him. He was like, positioned a certain way to where he had his back to me, and I was playing nervous because I was trying to hold back. I was just trying to, like, not mess up, and he could, like, feel me. Like, he could feel what I was doing. He was like almost cussed me out, but not really, but he does cuss a lot. That's what a lot of people don't know. He could cuss, so he was just, like, firm. He was like, no, don't play it like that. Like, play it the way you're doing it or whatever, how you want to do it, and it kind of, that was a great moment. I think musically, because then I was like, I wasn't afraid to, like, play after that. Like, you know what I mean? Like, as a musician, you try to, like kind of hold back depending on who it is. And then they were like, no, just do your thing. And so then it made me feel good because he sounded like an uncle. Like, it was like somebody, like, you knew that was giving you this advice. So it wasn't just like somebody you was just like a boss or somebody just like telling you something. It was like somebody trying to help you and stuff like that. So it was pretty. It was a pretty cool experience.
Oh, I
and they did
imagine.
A jazz album.
I had a friend that did a couple gigs with George. And, he said something very similar to that.
Yeah, you know, and he's
George
very serious, too.
Him in a hotel room, and he said, listen, you know, do you. That's why you're here. you know. Uh-huh. I need you to play this. And don't get too fancy, you know, just.
Right.
I need that funk.
Right, exactly. And that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to find that line. And it was, at that time, that's when I was, like, new to it. Like, not that new, but it was, like, that was maybe my sixth year into it. And I was like, oh, my God. And because, you know, 6 years still feel like you're, like new to it. I don't know what it is, but 6 years, I was like, oh. But still, I was like, oh, man, I was acting, you know. But then he, like, brought that out of me. And that was, like, one of those moments as a musician. It was like, wow, this is what it is right here, like just finding that knowledge, finding that go-to person that brings that out of you is like crazy. But
hey,
I was going to...
I might have last time, but I don't remember. There's not a lot of cute names. What is that? It's like Quintella?
Say it again.
Quintella? I don't know. What is it?
What is what?
What is
the
Q? First?
You heard him.
Oh, my Q? It's.
Provision.
Oh, you're going to put my government out there. Okay. You going to have hold my whole name.
You don't have to.
You know
Quenisha.
What?
It's fine. It's Quenisha.
It's Quenisha.
I wasn't far off. Okay.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
It's Quavassier with a Q.
Acting over it.
Yes. Thank you.
In the 80s, that was it.
Yeah,
that's what it was.
It's the day
my
too.
My mama was fancy in the 80s. Wow. She was trendy in the 80s, so that's what she went with.
EB, I needed that. I needed that badly.
The accent, the A has an accent over it.
Uh-huh.
Kovacier,
yeah.
Kovacier.
Love it. Oh, man. We gotta get to it before we run out of time. I was gonna ask Whitney if she had any questions for Monty before we get into the musician talk.
I know what she's gonna say. She's gonna say, "Who are you?"
I
never heard of you.
So that's not what I was gonna ask.
Okay.
You could tell us if you want to. I was gonna ask, like, do you remember, like, when you got to a point to where you realized, like, hey, I'm pretty talented? Like, did you ever have just that moment where you really felt that about yourself?
Oh man, that's a dangerous question, because it's hard to answer that without sounding egotistical.
Right.
But I think when you're a kid, you know, if you start young enough, you know, you get indications from your friends and, you know, the school situation. You know, I knew there was some talent. I didn't know what direction it was going at that time. You know, I started playing drums when I was 10 years old, and then started building the other instruments after that. But I would always be one of those kids, you know, that they would single out to perform in front of the class. You know, there weren't a lot of guys that could dance, and I was one of those guys. So it was me and, like, two other cats. They would always, you know, have us do a little feature. And like I told you last year, when I was growing up, the big thing was the stand-up groups, you know, the Temptations and the Dramatics, Blue Magic, people like that. So it seemed like everybody and their cousin had a group, and, you know, I had a number of groups. So, you know, we also did that. So I had indications all along the way that there was some talent there, but, you know, mostly it was about love. I just loved music so much and wanted to be connected to it. And I loved show business so much. I just loved the whole thing of it. So that's basically how I would answer that question. I had some indication, like, pretty early.
All right. Just curious. And then the other one is, do you have, like, a favorite instrument, or one that you feel like more drawn to compared to the other ones that you play?
Yeah, that's a great question. I get asked that a lot, and I just love to play music. I like making music with other people, and instrument I'm playing does not really matter that much if the music is really good. No, I want to be able to express myself on all the instruments I play. I work a lot on keyboards. I do a lot of singing. You know, I do a lot of more jazz gigs on the Vibes. And I'm just happy as can be in any situation. It's not like I really have a preference. If I was unable to do any of those things, I would be less happy. But not like I miss doing the other thing when I'm doing one thing. When I'm playing vibes, it's not like, man, I really wish I had my guitar right now. Or, you know, if I'm playing keyboards, it's not like, man, I really wish I was playing vibes. You know, it's funny. But even on the group, our band, at the Sugar Bar on Wednesdays, you know, the leader of the band, let me preface this by saying I've kind of become the musical director of the group, and, you know, I'm featured because I do all the singing, et cetera, et cetera. But there's actually another leader of the band. He started the band, and he had the band there before I joined. But, you know, he'll say, you know, I want to play vibes with you. I want you to, you know, bring the vibes down. You think I could buy some vibes? You know, he didn't know that he was talking about, like, $5,000. He thought he was going to put out, like, $300 to $500, and we'd be cool. I said, no. No, if you want to buy some vibes.
I'm laughing because I know musicians and stuff like that. That's
yeah, funny. I mean, he was going to get like electronic version, like a Malik cat, you know. And I'm like, well, you're still going to spend $3,000 if you want to do that,
right?
You know,
but
I, you know, I don't even think like that. It's like, listen, I play keyboards. That's what I do, and you can just think of me that way if you want to, because that's what I do with this band, and I'm completely happy. I don't feel like I need to play vibes. I know I love singing all night, whatever. So that's a long answer to your question, but no, I don't really have a preference, but I would be very sad if I had to stop any of it.
Right.
Yeah.
That's it. You got any more questions? Or?
No, that gave a lot of information right there, so I'm pretty satisfied with my question.
All right.
Cool.
Right on.
Okay, now we can start my
mini. You're not getting paid for this.
Right. you guys can Whitney dance.
Questions, that's it?
No, that's just from me, yes, because I know you there's other questions that are going to be asked.
Better freestyle. I'm just playing. I like to
laugh. Oh, man. Marnie, can we start our therapy now? Because I need therapy. Because I have
all right.
a trying time.
We don't have that much time.
I'm trying to make this.
Wait, what?
We don't have that much time.
I don't need you to interrupt my therapy right now.
Wait.
No, listen, both of y'all, Evie and Will, y'all like to deny y'all internal issues. I like to, like, bring them out and, you know, somebody
that's
going
to. I have a question, though.
Yours are obvious.
Oh, go ahead, Evie.
Should Will, Whitney, and I be here for this therapy, or is it a private session? Like,
no, it's not a private session. This is something that the listening audience, we have a lot of musicians, a lot of singers that listen in on the show, and so this is just reflective of the musicians that try to do their own thing. This is, and it,
okay.
I think it would help.
All right.
I'm just saying that.
It's all relative. And then, if you're not a musician, you can understand this as well. Anybody, a business owner, Will can take advice from me.
No, I'm just saying, you know, I don't know how much time Marnie has.
Oh my God! You act like I got like a multitude of like issues. Like,
uh-huh.
I feel like this is like sort of a gateway to something else, and I appreciate that.
You
this
said it.
Like, trying to, you know, make it seem like I need like extensive, you know, psychological therapy or something. And I appreciate that.
I appreciate this. Yep.
You see, Marty, you see the disrespect I get on it. You see me just simply wanting to ask you questions. It just bothers them. You see what I'm saying? If I was making Oprah Winfrey money, they wouldn't be talking to me like this. You see what I'm saying? It's just the compound of disrespect that I receive.
You told me we're going to break in 5 minutes. There's no way in the world that Monty's going to be able to help you in 5 minutes.
You just interrupted 4 minutes of that. So I'm trying to regulate me. So I just simply wanted to ask him a couple of questions, and then we were going to go to break again.
Okay.
That's all right with you. I just wanted to have a little bit of therapy.
Yes,
you
ma'am.
Call it questions, interview questions. I call this side music therapy because I need it.
Bam.
Okay.
This is going to keep me from hitting the hard drugs, y'all. From hitting the.
Wow.
It's going to keep me from. You know, people got their drugs, they got alcohol, they got, you know, it's that intense for me. I didn't want to make it that intense, but y'all make it seem like, okay, let me get to it because we ran out of time. Okay.
Okay.
Monty, okay, you got to finish. Okay, putting together, I don't know if you do your own projects, or I guess doing your thing at Sugar Bar, that would be sort of that. How hard is it for you when you have an idea as a musician and it has to, you have to add different components to it, like putting a band together, putting a list together? How hard is it to, like, stick with that? And then how do you handle the emotional that emotional thing that takes over when, you know, people, you know, don't answer their phone when they're supposed to, you know, musicians don't, you know, how do you, and then also a factor of, like, your...
Well, don't add anything else because the question is getting...
Right. No, I'm just adding on to that. No, just the side piece of that, like, how do you know when to judge when a musician, like, who to depend on when you try to do a project? That's how I was trying to tie it together.
All right. Okay, so I'll take that part first, and then we'll work our way back, because I don't want to forget. My memory's not what it used to be.
We shouldn't have the same memory, Monty.
It's really easy to, generally, it's really easy to tell the musicians you want to be working with on the personal level and on the professional level. Those are the people that get back to you, turn your calls, very polite about it, they're conscientious about it, and they act like they really want to play with you. They give you that energy. It's like, yeah, this is something I want to do. I want to be here. Even if they can't make, you know, the gig, said gig, you know, you get that energy from them that, wow, they, you know, they really want to be a part of this, and that's what I need. I don't need to, like, beg someone and feel like I'm cutting into somebody's schedule to get them to work with me. So that part is very easy. You can always tell. You can always tell. Nobody fools you on that because people show you who they are. Okay, now, what was the other part of the question if we go back a little more?
Is this how you deal with, like, because I said, like, I get that. But then what are the ones that sell you the dream, like, oh, I'm going to be there, like, on time and all that, and then when it comes that day, when you first work with them, they don't show up. Like, what do you?
Again, unfortunately, you have to go through that experience. And then you write them off. I mean, you have to write them. You can't extend yourself to the point. You can't do a whole lot of second chances. I mean, if you know the person personally and you really like them, then maybe, yeah, you give them a second chance. But sometimes your closest friends take you for granted the most. You know?
Right.
They take advantage of the relationship and they don't. You know, they kind of try to keep it on the friend thing and don't deal with it in a professional sense, which is not great. So I can't really deal with those people either, even though I love them. You know, I just got to compartmentalize and say, you know, these are my friends. These musicians over here are my friends. They're close friends. I've known them a long time, but I can't really work with them. You have the other ones that, again, they give you that energy, you know, even if they do know you well and they've known you a long time. They give you that energy of like, yeah, I really want to be here, and I really respect what you do, and, you know, you're this, you're that, and, you know, I want to be a part of it. So, you know, again, that's easy. But, you know, just navigating people, you know, not returning your calls, it's difficult. I mean, I know what you're talking about when you ask the question because it definitely affects you emotionally. You know, it affects your ego. Like, you know, how dare they, you know, not call me back, you know?
It ain't even that. It's just like my money. Like, you just wasted my time and money because it's me putting the money up. Like, all you got to do is show up with your instrument. That's it. That's all I'm asking for. And then this is going to lead to something else. But the thing is, people like to see the glitter and gold of it. And so they don't want to stick with you until you get to the where we're supposed to go. They want it, like, right up front. And I'm like, yeah, we're building this from scratch, so... If you're going to be a part of this, then you have to help make it get to that point. You can't just come on when the money comes. My thing is just wasting my time and my money. And when you do that,
well,
that is, like, that's what gets me. And I can't, it's, like, so hard to, like, trust musicians when you're, like, building something from scratch. Certain projects when you put money into it. Because then it's like I don't have, like, I have to always have a plan B if they don't show up. And I'm tired of having a plan B if somebody don't show up.
The thing is, when you're building something, that's a tricky scenario from the beginning. when you kind of, because you're asking people to kind of partner with you in a way.
Right.
And that could be cool, but for me, that never works. And on this level in New York, it definitely doesn't work. So
right.
Whatever I'm trying to do, I just try to make sure people get paid. You know, I mean, that's really becomes the bottom line of it. You know,
yeah,
you
just hit me with a hard truth right there, man. Because now I got to just get with the professional. I just got to get with the professional. I'm trying to get the homegrown thing going, but you just saying I just got to, that's what I got to do then. Because that's what I've been trying to do, but it's like, I guess I'm too nice. I guess that's what it is. Because I gave maybe two chances to somebody, and then it was like that, like you said, like I put it back in my head, like, all right, I ain't working with you no more. And then soon it was over with. And then when they saw, like, how great the project turned out, like, right. Then they were like, oh, we got to do this again. I'm like, oh, we not.
Right.
I was like, right. I'm like, we ain't doing
You're
nothing
not.
After this.
But
I was like, because you costed me, when you cost me production time and you cost me just, you affect everything with that because you're late. Not even just, like, not showing up, but when you're late and then you don't, you're, like, I have to, it's just crazy, like, how, like, some musicians are just, like, that inconsiderate and just oblivious to, like, everything that goes on. But, like you said,
yeah, I mean,
that's
I had,
a hard
even
truth.
Even when I had...
All right, my therapy's
way,
over
way
it.
Back in the day, way back in the day when I had a deal on a major label, I was on Columbia Records, which became Sony Records. You know, we had nice budget, you know, I was taking care of the guys, you know. Guys, you know, would stumble in late, you know, complaining about the parking situation. You know, so you never forget those things. I mean, I'm going back almost
right.
30 years with that, but I know what you're saying because, you know, it cuts deep and you never forget that. But the thing is, you got to remember. You got to remember, okay,
yep.
I got the vibe
right.
from that person. I'm going forward because you're always going to be able to find somebody that wants to do the right thing by you. And you got to just
right.
remember that, believe that. And back to what I said, you got to try to pay people. I mean, just the gesture of trying to give them something for their time, it can
right.
make a world of difference to people. You know, I try to pay in situations where a lot of people don't, like for rehearsals. Like,
oh,
people don't pay
yeah,
for rehearsals anymore.
Right.
That's supposed to
right,
be
right,
a paid
right.
situation, you know, but people, that's kind of gone by the wayside. But, you know, I try to, like, do a little something for rehearsal or pay them a little extra money for the gig and split it up and say, well, I'll give you this cash for the rehearsal and I'll pay you the balance on the gig. I mean, just
right.
those gestures like that, people really feel that and they feel your sincerity that you're trying to make something happen because everybody's out here trying to do something and everybody's life is complicated and people have, you know, families and situations, day jobs, the whole thing. So you, people can relate when you extend yourself in that way. Because, like they say, money talks. I mean, and it is
right.
a business. So, you know.
It is. Yeah, you definitely just made me, like, compartmentalize, like, what I need to do. My therapy's over with now. Okay, we can go.
Right
break.
On.
That was all the therapy I needed. I told you I was only two questions I had. If, we go get to the music, we'll get to the black music, smart musicians when we come back. Y'all get it to the team.
Here's a new song I wrote, ladies and gentlemen. A song about a little girl. It's really a beautiful, beautiful young girl. Thank you, darling. She asked me to write this song. I promised her I would. It goes like this. Genesis, my girl, in all the world, there's no one sweeter. I will tell the world, I'll hold her tight and love her right deep down inside, till my body gives no more. Thank you. There's no world without my loving baby. Without Jay, life would be tragic for me without Jay. See, Jen's unique, one of a kind. Who says she loves me? When she goes to sleep, I kiss her face and think I'm the luckiest man. And I'm her greatest fan. There is no sweeter girl in all the land than my
And welcome back to the Soul Savvy Show. E.V., Q-Lynn Green, Whitney, and special guest Monte. I've got a question for you, the cast here. Wow, gone too soon, Marvin Gaye. Think of what he could have produced. I mean, just absolutely brilliant. Mm.
Right. I think, I don't know, man. He's a tricky cat, man. Because I feel like, I don't know, man. He was so heavy into, like, that drug life, man. Then I don't know if he would have survived. Like, I think he, where, how he perished, I think he wanted to perish. Oh, what are you trying to make my joke in between now? I was just serious. Oh,
Monty.
I'm sorry.
And Monty.
Monty,
can we go back to the therapy lesson? Monty, can we go back to the therapy?
No. That was a serious statement. No. Y'all, like, I made this up. Listen, oh, my God.
I get what you were saying, Q-Lynn. I do. I get it.
Well,
because you're right. He was. But at the same time, I think Marvin was significant in that he was so musically gifted that he was able to, I will say he's not one of the artists that was able to transcend genres, but everybody's not meant to do that. But he was able to move from the 60s to the 70s to the 80s with ease. And his voice, I had a debate with somebody on Twitter the other day. We were talking about the greatest voices of all time. And I forget who, but somebody was saying some BS about, because, you know, Aretha, in my mind, is the greatest voice of all time. And then a friend of mine brought up that, no, Marvin, you know, we were talking male or female, Marvin would rival Aretha in that respect. And I'm like, yeah, because Marvin had a voice that was one of a kind that people still emulate today. And his artistry, just as a musician, he understood, which I wish most or more singers did, he understood music and he understood the boundaries of his voice and he understood how his voice worked with different types of music and with different producers in the background. So to think about what Marvin will be doing today is kind of scary because, I mean, not today, because obviously, like Cuban said, he'd be strung out somewhere dead. But
well, not
yeah, but he didn't die from drugs. His dad didn't die from drugs.
But no,
I know he was killed. But
well, indirectly, yeah,
right. But I mean, to think about what he would have produced after 84, 85. I hate to speculate.
Could I just say, Marvin Gaye was a genius. And you talk about,
definitely,
you know, great singer. I don't like the great singers because they're all, like, incredible to me. And Marvin, when you talk about the greatest singers, you got to put Marvin Gaye in there.
Yeah.
Have to. And I didn't listen to the background singer show. You said you had a background singer show?
Yeah, right? I think it was last year. I think we talked a little bit about it. Well, it was underrated singers.
It was last year we talked about background singers. I thought you did it last week. But anyway, I think Marvin has such a profound effect on the way people do background vocals. I mean, I just hear it all the time. I mean, it's Marvin, that repetitive, you know, kind of line in the background. He'll take a phrase and do it over and over. And just like everybody does that now. I mean, Stevie Wonder even did it. You know, it's like, wow, everybody has really peeped Marvin's technique for background vocals. And, yeah, I mean, that's just one aspect. I mean, I had the honor of talking to Valerie Simpson about Marvin, you know, because Nick and Val, they produced.
Oh, yeah, they wrote
they produced,
his.
They wrote and they produced
yeah.
all those
right.
Marvin Gaye, Tammy Terrell tracks.
Right.
And they just did so much. But a lot of people don't know that they produced those records because they were really young.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked
nope.
why, you know, Berry Gordy took a chance on them.
Wow.
Being so young to produce like Marvin Gaye, you know, this
right.
the premier, one of the premier artists. And they said they kind of had to audition for it, you know, because Johnny Bristol and Harvey Fuch were produced mm-hmm. the first Asher and Simpson tune for Marvin and Tammy. But Berry had Nick and Val do their version of it too. And it was kind of a contest to see who did the best one. And Nick and Val won. So that's how they started producing Marvin and Tammy. But that's a little aside. I just thought that was an interesting story. But, you know, I asked her what it was like, you know, to work with Marvin because, you know, being so in control of everything, you know, and I've read things where, you know, he'd have a producer like Diana Ross's brother help produce the I Want You album. And it was like he didn't really have anything to do because Marvin was so focused and he knew what he wanted so much. But Valerie said Marvin was the easiest person in the world to work with.
Mm.
That it was just right. like, it was a dream. I mean, and plus he was so far advanced of all of his background singing partners, Tammy, Kim Weston. He said that Marvin was just so helpful to them. He brought them up. He tried to bring them up to his level. And that's why those records work so well. It was all Marvin. So
wow.
that's a little insider information that kind of blew my mind. But, you know, I love Marvin Gaye.
Right.
I love Marvin.
Oh, it's blowing my mind right now.
That was actually going to be one of my questions getting into the Black Music Month musicians topic of talking about singers with good musician ears. But we'll get to that in a little bit. To start this off, like you said, I was going to get in detail with it. Y'all cut me off and started laughing before I made my point. So I don't even know if I want to make it right now because y'all just completely just disrespectful and think it'll work for me at all times. I was trying to lead to a point. I think I can lead to it. I'll say Marvin Gaye was one of the best. This dude, which I think to me exemplifies like how great a singer he was it's a video that's like very popular on the internet of his rehearsals doing I Want You. And if you just like close your eyes, you think he's like standing up and singing, and he's just like laid out like on the couch with his eyes closed, just like singing like it's nothing. And I'm like,
yeah.
You know how much energy you need to do that? And he's like laying down, like projecting like all that soul in there. And then also, I think he has like one of the greatest, well, I don't want to get into it. We'll get to it later. We'll get to the musicians. If you ask me, the most underappreciated, the most disrespected person in the music industry to me, I feel, is the musician. I feel like everything, when it comes to music, when you think about it, from its existence, it all started with musicians. And so it's like it's like they started it, and then it's like when singers got it, like, oh, we can do this, and then they Billie Holiday, that era of jazz music that came through, and it became like popular, and they were like, oh, we don't need y'all anymore to be in the forefront. We'll let the singers do it now. And then the disrespect started to me. That's just from my synopsis of music history. Is that
yeah.
That's how I feel.
I
feel like it's the most disrespected. It's like musicians always treat it as an afterthought to me.
That's really interesting because I think a lot of singers would say just the opposite. You
know, I get that, but I'm saying in general, like just a regular music lover, like not like paying attention to who's like on the credits, unless you're like heavy in that. I'm just saying a regular person.
Sure.
I'm saying
used to
the thing, but I'm not saying majority. It's just a good amount of people that don't really like care that much for it.
No, I get that. I get that, and they didn't used to credit the musicians on records,
right?
You know,
right.
At a certain point, you know, now it's common, but. At a certain point, you didn't know who was playing what. I mean, you know, we went back later and found out the Funk Brothers were playing on all these records, Motown records and other records, you know. And then you found out about the Wrecking Crew doing this, you know, this other vibe over here, you know, playing for the Elvises and Sonny and Cher's or whatever, you know. But there was a time when you just didn't know. The musicians were anonymous. So, you know, what you're saying, I can dig it. It was true. And,
right.
You know, I went to the premiere of season 5 of Power last night at Radio City Music Hall. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you guys watch Power, but if you like it, you're going to love the first episode of this new season. It's lit. Crazy. I mean, they put you right back in it. You know, if you forgot the plot line or whatever, you're going to be right back in it. You're going to be saying, I can't wait till the next episode. It was crazy. But I brought that up because 50 Cent actually performed. But he had a full choir, and they had harmonized the theme song. Now, this is a big, rich town. They harmonized that whole thing. Choir came out in white robes. And then up from the basement, a full orchestra came up. And then 50 came up from, you know, beneath the stage. He came up. And, you know, it blew me away. It was awesome. But then, you know, I thought about it after, and kind of in keeping what you're saying, it's like all those musicians, they're like nameless, faceless people, you know. They're part of that conglomerate, you know, just like the choir singers. And, I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but it's just, you know, we play certain roles in life, you know, and it's true. Certain people get kind of lost in the mix, you know, if you don't, you're not up in front of it. You know, the whole thing was about 50 Cent, you know.
Right.
And he deserved that love and attention, I mean, because everybody's excited to see him. He earned that, you know. He earned that being executive producer of Power, not to mention his recording career and just being this real charismatic cat. But, you know, it had to be 100 people on stage, you know. Well, I don't know any of them. We don't know any of them. All we know is 50, you know. So that's just the nature of the beast, you know.
I was sitting there, I was doing, like, I just always do random research and stuff, but I was, like, researching jazz and stuff like that. And they said, like, its creation, like, spans over 100 years, you know, before it became popular. And then it said, you know, researchers, that they used to call it jay. Like, it was like a secret word, like they would call it jazz, like they spelled it before, it was like they call it J-A-S-S, and they said, right, it was like a dirty word that you couldn't say in front of women. I was like, that's interesting. I was like, oh,
well, I heard it was a word for sex.
Right. Yeah, like code words and stuff, for like, yeah. And then it's like how it spanned, they said, like, from like ragtime to like rock infused going into like the, I would say, you think like the 1940s, like late 40s going into the 50s, because that's when that whole, you know, rock and roll thing started happening. But you think it was like started from there, like when it started getting popular, jazz, like 30s or like the 40s?
When did jazz start getting popular? I think in the late 20s.
I would say the 20s.
Oh, okay.
Kind of like the jazz age and on through the 30s, 40s. On through the 50s, like, and creeping into the 60s, and a little taste of the 70s, too. That's when the jazz fusion came in
right,
the 70s. And then it seemed like a lot of the younger musicians started backtracking. You know, they started, like, being, quote-unquote, more traditional again. So it's like it was, like, forward motion through this decade, that decade. Then we get to the 80s. And, you know, guys started looking back, and that's kind of been that way ever since. But not just jazz. It's kind of like that in all music, in a way. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You know, even hip-hop was sampling. It was a new twist, but it was old music. It was kind of a new twist on old music, and spoken word wasn't new either, you know.
I have a question. Like, with jazz music, like, what is it with, is something specific about, I'll tell you, this genre, because it's like some, I guess, jazz fans and musicians, like, you think it's just that old school mentality of like purists. They hate being called purists, by the way, but I'll say it anyway because that's the only word I can describe it. Like purists, like you have to, I never understood that theory because like is different examples of like popular jazz musicians that kind of took their own interpretation of it and took it to a whole different level creatively. Like, why is it that, like, you know, some of them wanted to sound like a Miles Davis record or something like that. Like everybody like that's like dead artists they wanted to sound like. And then it's like, and then I heard Robert Glasper make the same sort of analogy with that. They want him to just play like dead artists all the time. But he's done like something so dope because he'll take like David Bowie records and he'll like mesh that with R&B, and then he'll put like, it's just amazing how like he fuses all that together. And I get it because I love David Bowie's music. So when he does that, I'm like, oh, he's playing that record from American. He's playing that record. I was like, oh, that's crazy. But what do you think of like, what is that thing to where it's like a music purist, you have to like play it like jazz this way. And if you don't play it, then you're not a real jazz musician.
Yeah, that's a heavy question. I think part of it is like human nature. You want whatever it is that you do to be the thing. So, plus, in a practical sense, you want to be able to work. So the more people you convince that your thing, whatever you like, is the thing, the more likely you will be able to, you know, your career will be able to flourish and you'll be able to continue to work. Why people come to that choice that they just want to be, quote-unquote, traditionalists, I don't really know. I don't know why that kind of occurred with my generation, you know, in the 80s. And I don't know why guys made that choice, why we kind of went against, you know, the funk and the fusion and doing something progressive. But, you know, people to this day, there's people who, like, fight vehemently about it, you know. I'm like, man, really?
Yeah.
I mean, but things gradually change anyway. I mean, you can't. You can't fight the tide of history, you know. You know, the backbeat has spoken. People feel that beat, you know. They feel, I mean, it doesn't mean that swing or bebop music is not valid or should not continue, but, you know, still the people have spoken. We like that funk, you know. We want some funk with our jazz, you know. This is the only way we're going to enjoy it. So, you know, take us or leave us. This is what we want. And to a certain extent, you can't deny it. I mean, that's why now you hear funk beats on jazz stations, where when I moved to New York, you would never hear a funk beat on a jazz station. Never. Never.
Right.
I mean, well, I won't say never. Very rarely would you hear a backbeat on a jazz radio station. You know, but now everybody's got a little funk in their music. And, you know, people talk about jazz purists, but jazz was never pure. Jazz was always a mixture of this and that and different cultures, and, you know, it's all good. And you really do your research. There are records where Duke Ellington has a funk beat on his record, and, you know, Louis Armstrong and, of course, Miles Davis. I mean, he kind of led the way on a lot of it, so.
Right, exactly.
There's a lot of, you know, I think a lot of it, again, is really self-interest. You know, you want people to embrace whatever it is you have chosen to do. Okay, you say, okay, well, I don't want to play funk beats, so, you know, funk beats are not what's happening. You know, the swing thing is what it is. So that's, y'all need to get on board with this, you know. But it's really self-interest, you know. It's what you do. How obvious is that? That's transparent. You know, it's what you do. You want people to embrace it, so, you know, you have more gigs or more money or whatever, you know.
Right. It was a jazz musician that said... I can't think of his name, but he said jazz is a construct. And I was like, yo, it is. And it was like, the way he described it, he was just saying that it's like so much commonality with it. And it just, basically, it just has enough in common to where you just, like, I guess follow that line to figure out what it is, musically, what it's doing. And I was like, yo, that's dope.
Yeah, I mean, so many things. I mean, we have that title, jazz, but it just means so many different things to so many people. And, you know, it's a lot of people don't want to use the word anymore. And I understand where that's coming from, you know, because people are up on this black cultural thing. You know, it is our music. But, you know, for most people, jazz is, today, jazz has a very positive connotation. People think of it as something, you know, special. I mean, even if they don't really listen to it, they know that it's something special. So I'm not really on that bandwagon. I was gonna say, you know, I play straight ahead jazz. You know, when I do vibes, I really love to play in a straight ahead context. You know, I don't really do the funk jazz mix when I'm doing that. But you know, I don't get on a soapbox about it, you know, and I try to make it so people can feel it and still relate to it, and I try to make it soulful. But I'm not on a mission about it. You know, it's like I just try to tell the musicians, like, listen, I understand. I'm a straight-ahead jazz musician, too. Now, I do these other gigs where it's just an R&B gig. You know, I do these other gigs where, you know, when I'm playing keyboards, you know, we have maybe a little fusion lean on it. So I understand all of that, but I never felt a need to, like, get on a soapbox about it or make people do something. How are you going to make somebody do something, you know? I can't make you love me if you don't. You know that song?
Right. Yeah.
That's really what it is.
Bonnie Raitt.
Wait. I'm thinking of the Prince song. I'm tripping.
Bonnie Raitt, yeah.
Bonnie Raitt, yeah.
Yeah. Will, you said you had a question. I hope I misread that and you got one question. I hope I didn't read that and say five questions.
I didn't say five. Anyway, you interrupted.
No, I misread it then. I was just needing clarification, okay?
Okay.
That's all I was asking for.
Marty.
I've been raising my voice.
Okay.
All right, ask the question.
No problem. Okay, you interrupted my time here. Marty, she needs more therapy.
Oh, my God.
But anyway, Marty.
Let me go. All right.
Okay. Marty, yeah, you know, first of all, thank you so much for coming on because I'm thoroughly enjoying this interview. You guys picked out another song.
It's not an interview. He's a guest host. We already interviewed him the last show he was on. It's just him talking. We just talking about music.
Well, thanks for interrupting. Appreciate that, Q-Lynn. Okay. All right.
Yes.
Anyway.
I was just telling you, we had a mini interview earlier, but go ahead.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Q-Lynn. Really appreciate it. All right, Marty, thank you, sir. Anyway, I'm thoroughly enjoying this. As a guest host, thank you, sir. I really appreciate it. Speaking of, one of the songs that you guys picked out was Isaac Hayes. And real quickly, I remember I was in college, right? And we were playing, Homecoming one week. And the music was perfect. It wasn't Isaac Hayes at that time. But we screwed, the band director screwed up. He screwed up really bad because he had us precision marching in the mud, and it was so embarrassing. Sidney Poitier was there, and also Sidney Poitier, I think Richard Pryor was there as well. But anyway, wow. Going back, man, so we screwed up badly. The whole audience and our even home crowd, they were booing us, right? And so pouring down rain. And so we were marching off and I marched straight out of the studio, right out of the stadium. So, but anyway, the next week, the band director made up for it. Okay. He made up for it. He, wrote out the entire soundtrack for Isaac Hayes, that Shaft album. And, and one of our main things was, and so we didn't do any marching. The field was dry and I was playing the tuba. I was playing the tuba and he put me out front and we rocked the entire thing. And so I guess my question, man, it was so incredible. Give us your opinion about Isaac Hayes and the brilliance that he brought. I mean, the orchestra, because he wrote, and also I understand that he was part of Stax, or even owned part of Stax Record at one time, didn't he?
Yes.
Oh, well, see, now you're schooling me. I didn't know he had, some ownership of the label.
I think he did.
No, he did. He did.
Wow, that's deep. That's very deep.
Yeah.
Very instructive. Ike was an incredible writer and producer for Stax. You know, all that Sam and Dave stuff. He did that with David Porter. Hold On, I'm Coming, Soul Man. Did Carla Thomas. Just on Barcade, just on and on. And he was one of those cats behind the scenes. We talk about the nameless, faceless. He was one of those cats because he was playing on those sessions, you know. He was produced the Emotions before Maurice White picked him up for Columbia Records.
Sure did.
So, yeah, and he's playing on all that stuff, you know. It's really amazing. That's a great point you brought up about musicians not really getting the credit because it's just so fascinating to learn, you know, like Leon Huff, you know, of Gamble and Huff in Philly, not to get off the point. I'll get back to Isaac in a second. But you know, a friend of mine, the late Victor Bailey, was raised in Philadelphia. So he witnessed a lot of those Philly International sessions in the 70s because his pops worked for Philly International. He was one of the writers, Morris Bailey. And, you know, we were just talking one night about the musicians. And, you know, I said, yeah, Leon Huff, man, he played on a lot of stuff. And Victor was like, Leon Huff played on all of this stuff. He's like, if it wasn't him, it was Dexter Wansell. But, you know, Leon Huff played on almost all of those records, you know. And it's just crazy, you know. You hear those songs become the soundtrack of our lives, you know. But you don't really, until you learn, it doesn't really click with you that I'm listening to Leon Huff right now. Leon Huff came up with that intro. Leon Huff is playing that, you know. So, yeah, we are like the nameless, faceless. But, yeah, Isaac Hayes. When the Shaft soundtrack came out, my parents decided to take a vacation. We went to New York, and Isaac was playing at the Apollo Theater the week Shaft soundtrack came out. So we went to see Isaac, and, you know, I'm a little kid at this time. But it was just so heavy because, you know, Ike had this dancer, Helen Washington was her name. She was bald-headed, too. So it just looked, like, really freaky. Are you guys still here?
Yep. I remember
okay,
that.
Okay. I'm all
no,
in.
I just, well, I
we're listening.
On my phone. Yeah, no, I heard a little click on my phone, so I didn't know. Yeah, she had this dancer, Helen Washington. She was bald-headed, and it just looked so freaky. I'm a little kid, you know. This was, like, all this was shocking, you know. But I'll never forget that because that was the first week of that classic album, Shaft, you know, and Ellie's Love Theme was a song, you know, I pinpointed for you guys to play tonight. Because, again, there's vibes on that, and Isaac Hayes is playing the vibes. And I remember him seeing, there's a clip on YouTube of Isaac playing Ellie's Love Theme and playing the vibes on the David Frost Show, which is an old talk show back in the 70s. David Frost, he used to be hooked up with Diane Carroll, you know. Throw a little trivia in there, those of you who are interested. But the vibes, you know, I had started, you know, playing the vibes again when I was 14, so this was after the Shaft soundtrack, but it was still in my head. And that Ellie's Love Theme, one of the first, again, another one of the first things I tried to play was the melody of Ellie's Love Theme. And, you know, I listened to it today, and I was just like, wow, this is still a beautiful tune. And, you know, the soundtrack is amazing, and it was you know, it set the pace, you know, for, you know, the Curtis to come out with Superfly and Bobby Womack for Across 110th Street and, you know, Willie Hutch and, you know, the various people in Roy Ayers doing the Coffee soundtrack, you know. Isaac Hayes set the pace, you know, and he won an Academy Award on top of it for Shaft, you know. So
it was brilliant.
He was really, really an amazing dude and a great singer. We don't talk about that. One of the great singers, versatile singer, great instrumentalist, you know, long songwriting list. His record, when you investigate it, it just speaks for itself. Just incredible, incredible cat.
Man, by the time you get to Phoenix, I stand accused.
Wow. Longest song I've ever heard in my life. My daddy used to play that.
Yeah.
And I used to know, okay, see going through something, and I'm going to listen to this all night long.
Yes, sir.
I had a question. Since we already on there, the musicians, like, who's y'all, like, songs that, I guess I should say, like, songs that, like, have great, like, instrumentalists on there and made you, like, I guess I should say, like, the first song you heard where you, like, pay attention to the instruments in there. Whitney, you can go first if you want to. Like, what's the first song you listened to that was, like, it don't matter what era it was, like, whatever song that you listened, like, you was like, oh, the band sounds good, like, something like that.
I wanted Whitney first.
I think Whitney went to get some of Will's Pinot Grigio.
Well, sorry. Let me. Wow.
Where'd she go?
I got a question.
Oh, I think she, we'll go to Monty. Monty, you answer the question then. What's the song that made you made you pay attention to the instrumentation?
You know, back in the day, back in my day, it was rare. I mean, you would have hit records, that were just instrumental. I mean, well, that's been unheard of for a long time now. But back in the day, you would have instrumental records that were his. You know, the Barclays had some. There might be a little chant or something on it, but basically they were instrumental. I think of Dennis Coffey, Scorpio. Y'all know that record?
Yes, I know that record.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's a bad one right there.
Oh, man.
Classic.
Thanks for
bass solo. Yeah, and Dennis Coffey, he's one of the major voices. Again, he was a funk brother.
Oh, yep.
So all that Temptation stuff with the wah-wah pedals and the octave divider and the distortion, that was Dennis Coffey playing like on Cloud Nine, Psychedelic Shack, wherever you hear that guitar like that, that was Dennis Coffey.
And, man.
Yeah, so when Scorpio came out, that was one. Edgar Winter, you remember that record, Frankenstein?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was another one. So when the instrumentals came out, you know, well, they were really focused on the band, so you couldn't help but, you know, focus on that. You know? And then Billy Preston's records like Outer Space, you know, Space Race, where he would play, you know, synthesizer and clavinet, you know, so tunes like that or would come to mind when you ask a question like that, you know, because, you know, we get those hits back in the day, you know, that was part of the whole experience. You have instrumentals, ballads, novelty songs, just the love songs, protest songs. I came up in a great era, you know. It's just so different now. Music is so dark, man. Listen to pop radio, man. It's like so gangster and like funeral almost. I'm like, what are y'all listening to, man? Come on. And the subject matter is like, I don't even know what a lot of them are talking about.
I have to agree with you. Monty, what made that Philly sound? That Philly sound was so unique, different from a lot of different producers or record companies. What made that Philly sound so unique back in the day?
Philly sound. I always say when I'm listening to Philly International Records, I feel like I'm riding in a limousine.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that's what it feels like to me. You know, Motown was the sound of the 60s leading to the 70s, and then Philly kind of took it over from there. With that same kind of vibe. Motown was mono, going into stereo. No, Philly International was full stereo.
Talk now.
And it was real dramatic, too, like it was theme music. Like at all times.
Because
the horn section and, yeah, I'll go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I always say, like the Philly sound, to me, represented the black journey in America and black pride. It was so nuanced, and you had the orchestra, and then you had the horn section, and then on top of that, you had these amazing vocalists, and then at the forefront of all of that, you had the producers who were like just crafting this amazing piece of work that really, what I think, I mean, I think Motown is, of course, you know, monumental, but Philadelphia International, to me, is just, their sound was unlike any other, and it was, I know they called, I think in the 60s they called Motown the sound of black America. But
they called it the sound of young America. They called
it young America. Philadelphia was the sound of black America, like all the way, without a doubt, between Stax and Philadelphia, that's the sound of black America, you know, according to the geographic locations, but I just think Philadelphia was probably, one of the most, if not the most, influential label in terms of, you know, the way their sound carried over to other labels at the time. And then, you know, labels who came along after them. I think Philadelphia takes the cake for that.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, it was like high def stereo, man. I'm serious. Coming out of Philly, it was crazy. What about some of those groups that came out of that Philly Sound organization? Now, let me ask you, OJs, were they under the Philly label?
Yeah, they were Philly International. They're from Ohio, but they were Philly recorded.
I'm thinking Intruders are under that label, too, I think.
Absolutely.
Oh, man, we can go down the list.
We could go on. I mean, because, you know, there was the Tom Bell arm of that, you know, which was kind of together, with, they call it Mighty Three, their publishing, because it was Gamble Huff and Tom Bell.
Yep.
He had his own kind of vibe.
Yeah.
No, it was kind
of him
like,
and Linda Creed.
Spinners, Elton John.
It was
kind of,
there you go.
All that stuff. Those funky
stylistics. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, stylistics, Dramatics.
Oh, man.
Yeah, Dramatics were Detroit. Dramatics were Detroit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, right. Stylistics. But I'll Be Around record. That's my favorite record.
And Blue Magic.
From Tom Bell.
Oh, Blue Magic. Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yeah, Blue Magic is one.
Magic of the Ooh. Blue, yeah, that's
oh,
that
my
really
goodness.
Sound right Ooh. There.
But my favorite is Children of the Night, Stylistics.
Yeah,
you know what?
Great record.
I like the Jones Girls cover of Children of the Night better than I like the Stylistics.
And what about Nights Over Egypt?
Oh,
of
boy.
I mean, that's the most perfect song in the history of songs, so I mean, that's
Dexter Wansell. That was Dexter Wansell.
Of course.
He brought another vibe to the Philly vibe. Because you had individuals. You had McFadden and Whitehead. They had a vibe. Gamble and Huff had a vibe. Bunny Siegler had a vibe. You know, and they all brought their own thing. Dexter Wansell, he brought that almost a jazz flavor to it. You know, very instrumental minded. You know. Yeah, I love that stuff. Philly was something else, boy.
Yeah, man.
Working
Blue
with
Magic
like
and
Gene
the Stylistics.
Korn.
You talk about Blue Magic and the Stylistics. You know the role model for those groups were the Delphonics.
What?
That's where that started with Tom Bell.
That's who
I was getting it confused with. The Dramatics. I meant to say Delphonics. That's who it was. Because I remember they got a crazy young song. That's crazy to me. Like, they've been beefing for, like, over 30, 40-plus years. That's crazy. They still, like, they got, like, two separate groups and stuff. Because I remember, I forgot when it was. It was, like, a couple years ago. I remember they were saying it was, like, two separate groups, like, that performed. Like, that's crazy. But then some of them have died off. I'm like, y'all still beefing? I'm like,
the brothers split up, and I played with Fuji Bell, who is the main voice.
Get out.
We didn't tour anything. We did an episode of Luke Cage.
Oh, yeah.
Where the Delphonics were performing, and I was in the band.
So
I got to,
Luke Cage,
hang out
it
with
was,
Fuji Hart. I meant to say Fuji Hart. I think I said Fuji Bell, who's a drummer friend of mine. But, no, Fuji Hart, you know, the original voice. So I got to hang out with him for a minute. And you're
Speaking
right,
of,
yeah, brothers split up. They can't, I mean, families, man.
Right.
Yeah, it's hard.
Get along.
Family business, yeah.
Hey, guys.
I was going to ask you.
One thing I'm sorry, Q-Lin.
Oh,
go first.
No, go ahead.
Oh.
Go ahead.
We have left a group out, and I saw them, it had to be about 10 years ago, and these cats were as mean as they were in the 70s, Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Maurice White.
I think they just focused on the Philly.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I didn't know we had moved on from that, but we can finish it with Philly and then go to that because we got. Hey, if you Monty and EB and Q-Lin, if you will address that after we finish with the Philly.
Yeah,
that's
what
we're
going to do after the break. Was talk about our favorite brands, but I said favorite brands.
Oh,
we promoting. I meant favorite bands. That's what I thought we were going to talk about when we came back from the break.
No, you guys get me excited, man. I'm loving this, man. You guys are getting me excited. You know, and it's bringing back.
Yeah, I know you're excited because we didn't went over 7 minutes and we supposed to go to break. That's why I was going to take a break, but somebody talking for like 10 minutes. So I was like, I was ready to talk for 10 minutes.
But you know what?
He already started. We be back,
man,
y'all.
Thank you.
Lord.